Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Diane Keaton once said, "There was no love of my life except my mother." The award-winning actress has starred in some of the most memorable movies ever made, among them The Godfather Trilogy and Annie Hall. Now, in a new memoir, she writes about her life off-screen and the bond with her mother that defined them both. The book is titled Then Again. And Diane Keaton joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org and join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Diane Keaton, how wonderful to meet you.
Thank you. Thank you, Diane.
Yes!
Another Diane.
We are two Dianes here in the studio together. I want to tell people how you're dressed.
Oh, please do.
You have a darling. What kind of hat do you call that?
I would call this a men's bolero hat.
A men's bolero hat.
It's kind of with a high crown, though.
Yeah.
So I can push it down and hide my face, Diane.
And hide your face.
I'm not stupid.
We have been talking about this before we've gone on the air, about the fact that I have said I am never doing anything to my face. You had at one point said you would prefer not to do anything to your
face. I would
face.
Prefer it. But, you know, I'm always afraid when I make these pronouncements. It's sort of like when I was young, I said, I'm never, ever going to have intercourse before marriage. That would have been a big loss for me. And so I don't want to, like, you know, and I don't think that it's right to go to head shrinkers. I mean, some of the stupidest things came out of my mouth. I think that, I don't want to just make a law here. But I would prefer to age as gracefully as I can with the face I
am
given.
Exactly. I think with your face, you can afford to be an example to the world of what a beautiful woman's face looks like as it ages.
Maybe.
Okay, I want to talk
I like what you're saying.
I want to talk about the cover of your book because this is straight out of Annie Hall.
Oh, yes.
Your mom is on the back cover. That is such a gorgeous picture.
Is she beautiful?
She really is. She's absolutely beautiful.
She's handsome.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
I understand what you're saying.
Patrician.
Yeah.
Great straight nose. Beautiful face, actually. Beautiful. Wide jaw. But, of course, she didn't feel she was beautiful.
She didn't?
No. Mm-mm, not at all. No.
Tell me about your relationship with her growing up.
Well, of course, I was just devoted to my mother because she was devoted to me. My mother was by far the most active, intense, devoted listener that I've ever come across in my life. I used to love to spend time with my mother just sitting across from her at the kitchen counter and telling her about my problems. I had many problems, and she would always sit there, and she would always look and go, "Oh, Diane, it's going to be all right." She never made a judgment call. She just allowed me to go on and was always, as I said, actively interested. So she was this fabulous person to listen to, and she had a great sense of humor. So, you know, she would laugh and she would encourage me. And this is true with my siblings as well, Randy, Robin, and Dory. So this was a great gift. And I don't think people really understand how important listening is. You know, my problem in life has always been that I like to express myself. I don't like to listen as much as I like to express myself. But I'm learning, and I do think it's a great gift because I think it makes for a more enriched life. But it's hard sometimes.
It's hard.
You want to be the person who finds an audience and is seeking out attention. And my mother really did encourage all of us to to tell her what we thought. So she was really kind of like my first psychiatrist.
What about your father?
My father was very different, Jack Hall. He was always, he was a civil engineer. He had a very interesting background. His mother, Mary Hall, drove from Nebraska, brought him to California. And Mary was more man than woman. That's the way we described Mary. She was a fine Irish matriarch. And there was a difference between Mary and Grammy Keaton. There were these two Grammys. See, my mother's mother was Grammy Keaton. And of course, Grammy Hall was my father, Jack Hall's mother. And you would describe like Grammy Hall as, like I told you, more man than woman. And Grammy Keaton's face was filled with faith. We're talking about the 30s, 1930, right? And Grammy Keaton would always make us angel food cake. And Grammy Hall would always make us, when she did make a cake, devil's food cake. And Grammy Keaton was somebody who devoutly believed in heaven. And while Grammy Hall was a Catholic, she felt that heaven was a lot of bunk. So my father, you know, had this very unique mother who had been abandoned by his father. And she never told anybody. So we don't know who this man was, and she didn't allow anybody to ask questions. And so my father, of course, complied and never asked anything about his father. We sometimes wondered if he was a bastard. That's what you called him in those days. If you didn't have, maybe she hadn't married this man, Chester Hall. My father died never knowing anything about his father, including his first name. His first name was Chester. It turns out that Chester was a barber who had been killed in a labor dispute, murdered. So these stories just
wow.
Look astonishing.
Wow.
So this Mary Hall was some character. So my father wasn't really a man to discuss his feelings or things like that. He was very, he was encouraged success. He always asked me to ask a lot of questions. That's what he did. And I always... we're moving on.
No. I just
I don't want to keep going on.
I wanted to ask you whether your father was a listener.
Oh, my father was no one could be like my mother as a listener. She was graceful. She was encouraging and comfortable and warm. My father was a debater. My father and I used to debate together when I got older, and this became a kind of a way that I got to know him and enjoy him. He was also a man who loved nature. So we were, you know, we were a family of the 50s. We were a very average American family in Southern California in the 50s, and my father's heart went to the ocean. And we would camp out at Huntington Beach and Doheny Beach, and we were constantly driving and camping. And my dad would always sit out and look at the ocean, and that was the love of his life. He was a surfer. He was a skin diver. He was a man of the water.
Sounds as though
he was
more internal.
Yes.
And your mother opening herself to what
to
was
us,
coming.
To the children, yes. And I think that their marriage was a classic marriage of the 50s. Her role was to be, of course, the housekeeper and wife. And in fact, in my book, I talk about my mother had these other ambitions that, of course, she didn't really fulfill. But when she was young, she entered the Mrs. America contest at the local level. And this was at Mrs. Highland Park. She was trying to become Mrs. Highland Park. And I remember I was 9 years old, and there was this stage in this movie theater. It was the first time I'd been in a movie theater by myself at night. It was very exciting. I was sitting there, and I was looking, and my mother was on stage with four other women. And suddenly I hear her name. And then they put a crown on her head. It was like the most insane image ever. I will never forget it. And I'm going, wait, I don't understand.
What's going on?
What's my mother doing up there? What is this? And then the curtain parted. I'll never forget this. This curtain parted, and this cornucopia of gifts from, like, she had a wardrobe from Ivor's department store and a set of Samsonite luggage and a Philco washer and dryer. And I just was like, wait a minute, this is one of those milestone memories. You know, it's like that was the moment I knew that I would have to go on stage.
You wanted to be on stage.
Of course, it had to be me. And I also was very worried that what would happen to my mother if she, you know, she went on to become Mrs. Los Angeles, too, by the way. And she was crowned by Art Linkletter, the famous Art Linkletter, at the Ambassador Hotel. So we started to get very nervous in the family. Were we going to lose our mother? Like, was she going to become another Bess Meyerson or something horrible like that? And I wouldn't have my, you know, afternoon snacks with her. And where would she go? And why would she? But of
so
course,
what happened?
She made it to the finalists of Mrs. California, but I think she felt the pressure from kind of all of us that we didn't want her to win Mrs. America or go off and leave us and become a spokesperson for, I don't know, write a column for McCall's magazine. I don't know.
So instead, she turned her enormous mm-hmm. talent mm-hmm. to doing for you all and mm-hmm. writing
yes.
in these 85 journals mm-hmm. you found.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, she did. I remember seeing my mother kind of like when there was a moment, and there were not many moments, just trying to find a place to go be by herself for half an hour. And there, obviously, she had a whole secret world, an internal world that we knew nothing about. I think we instinctively felt it, all of us, but we didn't have very much curiosity because our need was so overpowering for her. You know, we didn't really want to know what it was like in her, what her dreams were, basically. You know, what were Dorothy's dreams? She was always enabling mine, but I didn't really want to know hers.
Diane Keaton and her new memoir with her as Annie Hall on the front and her beautiful mother, Dorothy Hall, on the back. We'll be right back.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
You want a lift?
Oh, why? You got a car?
No, I was going to take a cab.
Oh, no, I have a car.
You have a car? So, I don't understand. What, if you have a car, so then why did you say, do you have a car, like you wanted a lift?
I don't know. I wasn't. I got this VW out there. What a jerk, yeah. Would you like a lift?
Sure. Which way are you going?
Me? Downtown.
I'm going uptown.
Oh, well, you know, I'm going uptown, too.
No, wait a minute. You just said you were going downtown.
Yeah, well, but I can...
I'm sorry.
I can go uptown, too. I live uptown, but what the hell? I mean, it'd be nice having company, you know? I mean, I hate driving alone.
Yeah?
Diane Keaton, what's it like for you listening to that?
It's very different than seeing it. Because when you see it, and I have seen clips, obviously, of this scene, I get caught up in the visual. I'm more visual than right. verbal. And to hear it is so astonishing how Woody captured an essence of me. It's almost as if I'm listening to somebody in real life actually talking and actually, like reality TV. It's amazing what he wrote. It's absolutely astonishing how he captured the sound and the nuance and the kind of weird rhythm that I have when I speak, and also the kind of missed seconds. And it's his writing. It's just his writing.
He wrote that for you.
Yeah, he did write that for me. Yes, he did. And you can tell, because it sure sounds like me, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, and the other aspect to that is exactly as you say, it sounds like you.
Yes.
So he wrote it with you in mind. How did you and he first meet?
Oh, it was an audition for Play It Again, Sam, the play. I was in Hair at the time, and I knew a person who knew the director who got me the audition. So I met him on stage at the Broadhurst Theater, and I auditioned, and I got the part. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
Yeah, I know.
And then he wrote this for you.
Yes, he did. But as you know, if you look at Woody's, you know, Woody's work throughout the years, he really does have an amazing capacity to capture other people's voices, particularly women's. It's really quite a gift. Because it's almost like there was a tape recorder taping a conversation as opposed to having written it down. But he wrote that down. He created that scene. I never met him like that. It was nothing like that at all.
I was going to ask whether, in fact, that dialogue was simply on the spot.
No.
Because it is your voice.
Oh, I know.
Totally your voice.
No, this is his gift.
What was your relationship with Woody Allen at the time?
At the time, we were friends. We had been romantic and we'd been romantically linked before, but by the time Annie Hall rolled around, we were friends. We were no longer an item, as they say.
Do you see him now?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Oh, every time I go to New York City, I see him.
How did you feel when his relationship with Mia Farrow broke up?
I'm always sad when relationships break up because I know that there's a lot of pain attached to any kind of a breakup, particularly one involving, you know, a family. So it was sad, and I was very upset for all parties, like it always is.
Yeah. It's tough.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you'll ever make another movie with him?
I don't know. I went back in radio days, and I was he asked me to sing a song, and that was my idea of heaven. I always wanted to be a singer. So I don't know. I went back, you know, on Manhattan Murder Mystery as well. And that was extremely fun because he had changed his style. At that point, he was doing those handheld movies. I don't know if you remember those. Husband and Wives was one. So this was just like, oh, what are we doing? There's no marks. It's just free. And I remember he would go and he would look at a scene and he would say, this is just way too long. He'd go into another room and then he'd cut the scene in half, rewrite it, and boom, there you are again. And we're out there shooting that thing. And it was so much fun. It was so exciting. And it was, you know, like no one else. Always his movies, he's always had this tendency to downplay the role of the artist, the actor as artist. You know, I'd go up to him, I'd say, well, what should I be doing in this scene? And he would say, just do it. Don't
just
talk to me about
it.
Just do the scene and don't worry about it and stop standing on the mark so perfectly. Just be yourself.
Under stars, chilled by the winter, under an August moon, burning above, you'd be so nice, you'd be paradise to come home to.
Oh, my God. I wanted to be a singer so bad.
Did you?
Obviously, I've wanted to be many things.
Yeah.
Have you noticed?
Yeah.
There's a lot of, I wanted to be a designer. Now I've got this product at Bed Bath & Beyond. I'm a jack of all trades, master of none.
And you are.
And Chico's, of
and
course.
And Chico's on the cover of Chico's. The singing.
Yeah, the singing is still, oh, I love music and I love singing. And in fact, you know, I don't ever play music around the house. I don't ever want to hear it because it's too much. It is the most extraordinary. I can't live with music because it just takes you over. It's the most powerful of all the arts to me. Music, don't you feel that way? You listen to music and it just, oh, it takes your whole soul. Don't you feel that way?
I love to be in my car.
Oh, yeah, alone, right?
Alone.
That I understand, yes.
With the music surrounding me.
Exactly.
It's just fabulous.
And I love to sing. I still sing. I mean, you know, I love this. You know, I love all music, too. I don't know if you know Kanye West and Jay-Z. This new album of theirs, oh, my God. They're and I sing with them, and I'm thinking they probably think this very strange woman, this woman, you know, age 65.
I love it.
I jog and sing to Jay-Z.
I love it.
Kanye West.
I love it.
They're brilliant.
All right. I want to go back for a moment to your mother because you found these 85 journals.
Well, they were lying around the house.
Lying around.
Yes, yeah, so, but she had them in one room in particular, but she was always working on a journal. And I remember that I came across a journal in the 70s. This may be before or after Annie Hall. And I remember that I was using her dark room and I saw, you know, she was big. We were all into collage.
Gosh.
Collage was kind of the metaphor for our family, you know, just taking things, visual things, throwing them together, mixing them up, and then coming up with something new. And what were you looking at? And it was really a very exciting thing. That was one thing that Mother was just so, I don't know, she taught us how to see. She taught us how to appreciate beauty. I remember her taking me to a museum when I was a girl, and we were looking at statues, Greek statues or Roman statues, and the lion, you know how it is, like the lion would be missing its nose, or the woman didn't have an arm, and my mother would say, Diane, look at this. Just look at this, Diane. Isn't that beautiful? And I'd say, why? Why? They don't have, where's the nose?
Yeah.
And Mom would say, no, don't you see? Look at how amazing that is in itself. Look at that. And it's just, that's what she did for all of us. All of us are visual, and she taught us how to see in a way.
But once you got into these journals and began to really
that's a different
see
part of the life. Yeah,
your
the
mother.
Yeah.
What was the gut reaction on your part?
Well, at the first time, that time when I actually looked through one of them, I saw an item about, oh, she was working at Hunter's Bookstore, and she was making $1.39 an hour, and she was kind of excited by this. $1.39 an hour? I'm going, really? And then she, then I turned the pages, and I found this other excerpt that said, for you readers in the future, watch out, you know, you friggin' bastard, Jack. And I just went, that's it. I closed it. I never
because she was talking about
her real
dad.
Feelings. And she was talking about my father.
Yeah.
And it was too much for me to address her needs, her feelings, her aspirations for herself. And so so I never read any of her journals.
Did you say anything to her?
No. No, I pretended like I never seen it.
So then when you went back for the writing of this book and really took in those journals, what was your gut reaction?
My gut reaction was that it was like I was being transported back to then. Yeah, that's why I titled it Then Again. But it was then again where I was learning about my mother and how complicated and how her feelings were sometimes euphoric, but other times very insecure and unhappy and unfulfilled, that she didn't really have the I remember one time I read while I was reading this for the book that she had, I read a whole journal that was her intention to write her own memoir. And she titled it Memories. And it was just really about her early girl days. And it's in the book. And I used a lot of that. And you see that she really did want to write this. And she wrote me a letter. I have the letter. At the time, it must have been the 80s she had written that. And she wrote me a letter about wanting to write a memoir. And, you know, I had an agent at the time. I could have helped her out. She might have been able to have written her own memoir. And I did nothing for her. And I didn't even remember the letter, because it was convenient for me not to remember that she might have needed something. So just to tell you how I feel, obviously, a lot of regret that I was a person who insisted on remaining a daughter and not growing up in relation to my mother. I really wish that I, you know, why couldn't she have written a memoir? She did. She has the material. But it was kind of like she was asking me to be interested in her interests, and I just didn't take her up on it.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Diane Keaton is here in the studio. Her new memoir, just published by Random House, is titled Then Again. All right, we're going to open the phones and go first to Long Island, New York. Good morning, Scott.
Hi, good morning, Diane and Diane.
Thanks.
My mother's also Diane, so this may be the most Diane I've spoken to in a day. My comment is, Diane Keaton, you're really a part of my family history, probably without even knowing it. My twin sisters are 26 years old, and they were baby Elizabeth in Baby Boom.
No! Oh, no! Yeah. No! How are they? Oh, they were beautiful babies. Oh, my God.
They're beautiful girls.
Are they? Oh, that is fabulous. That is hilarious.
Yeah. So you come up in conversation all the time at family gatherings. I was 5 years old at the time, so I have some memory of it. But they're doing great, and we talk about you all the time.
Are they actresses?
No, they're both teachers.
They're teachers.
They're teachers.
That's perfect.
Scott, I'm glad you called.
Thank you, Scott.
I was very excited about this offer, but, you know, I don't think I really thought about what it meant. And you see, I'm not the Tiger Lady anymore. I mean, I have a crib in my office and there's a mobile over my desk, and I really like that. I mean, Fritz, do you remember that night when you told me about the things that I was going to have to give up and the sacrifices that I was going to have to make? Well, I don't want to make those sacrifices. And the bottom line is, nobody should have to. No, I don't think this is going to work out. And I'll be honest with you. I think I'm doing pretty good on my own. To be quite frank, if the food chain can put Country Baby on every supermarket shelf in America, so can I. I'm sorry. I just think the rat race is going to have to survive with one less rat.
And that was, of course, Baby Boom.
Yeah.
Tell us about your own children.
Oh, all right. Well, as you know, I adopted my daughter when I was 50. And Dexter is now 15 years old. And in fact, I'm flying home tomorrow to California, and on Saturday we have a big swim meet, and Dexter is going to be swimming the 200 back, the 200 breast, and we've got a big weekend ahead of us. So Dexter is a swimmer. She's part of a swim club called Team Santa Monica, and Duke is also a swimmer. That's my son, and Duke is 5 years younger than Dexter, and he's beginning to really enjoy tennis, and he's very fast. Duke is fast. So I think tennis is probably going to be the game for Duke, because so these sports have really kind of become, you know, my family, we were not sports oriented, really. In fact, growing up, look, you know, I thought it was disgusting for a woman to play sports in all events, because I was very interested in being Twiggy, You understand what I mean.
I understand.
Or Audrey Hepburn.
Of course.
I was interested in fashion, of course, you know. So now that I'm a sports mom, I can't believe where my life is. I mean, that my life has gone from one extreme to another. And it's so much fun for me. You have no idea. I so enjoy it.
What prompted you at age 50?
50, yeah. Well, as you know, I kind of failed in my relationships. I didn't quite manage to find a relationship that had any real lasting value. And my father, when I was about 45, my father, you know, he was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. And I'd been living my life basically, as we now know, pretty much involved with myself and my romances and my career. And I was driving him home. And he was, should I not say it?
No. I want you to finish it.
Diane is kind of an orchestrating person.
And,
you are. You're fabulous.
And at this point, we'll hold that story until we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes in communities worldwide and supporting World Diabetes Day, novonordisk-us.com. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org. And by CenturyLink, providing broadband, entertainment, and voice products to Americans coast to coast. Learn more at CenturyLink.com. This is NPR.
Director Alexander Payne's films find comedy in the crisis of his flawed protagonists, a struggling writer and wine snob in Sideways, a retired widower on a road trip in About Schmidt, and now a family man who must face a difficult truth in Payne's new film, The Descendants. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Alexander Payne. Join us.
Seems that just as we're having to break, Diane Keaton is in the middle of a wonderful story. Finish the story about your dad.
So he'd been diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, and he had been put on this experimental program, and he failed, and he was sent home to, it's the quality of life, not the quantity, which is, of course, ridiculous. But in any event, I was driving him home from the hospital, UCLA Medical Center, and we were just driving along, and I didn't know what to say to my father. I don't know, I felt awkward. And then suddenly he said to me, you know, Diane, I always hated my job. And I'm going, yeah, and I wish that I had spent more time with you, kids. I wish that I had traveled more. I wish I had taken more risks. And that was it. When he said risks, for some reason, that really resonated so powerfully for me, because I thought about all the risks that I hadn't taken, certainly in the revolving around the word intimacy. And so he really was the person who helped me come to realize that I had to make a decision about what my life was going to be. And I wanted to make a change. And I knew that... I knew that I was going to adopt a baby based on on that moment with my father.
Did you adopt the two at the same time?
No. Dexter was first, and then 5 years later it was Duke. Uh-huh. So I was 55 when I adopted Duke. 55 years old, yeah. Because I felt that Dexter needed to have somebody to experience what she would be going through with me. When she's 30, I'll be 80. I didn't want her to go through that alone. And also, I thought she needed to experience what it is to have a sibling, because for me, my siblings have meant so much in my life now. We've become even closer.
You not only saw your father go through brain cancer, mm-hmm. you saw your mother mm-hmm. go through difficulty at mm-hmm. the end.
Yeah, problems with the brain. Mm-hmm. Yes, my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 1993, and then again later. It was sort of like she might have this problem, and she got this letter, but then it was... The diagnosis became official, and I remember she told Robin, my sister, she said, just please be sure to remind me to kill myself before I get too far gone. I want to commit suicide. She didn't, of course, thank God. But she, in a way, she felt like she didn't want to be a burden to anybody.
I understand. Lots of people are asking about the movie Reds.
Do you believe in God?
I beg your pardon?
It's a simple question, Miss Brown. Now, do you want me to repeat it?
I'm sorry, for a moment I thought you asked me if I believe there's a God.
That is precisely what I asked.
I see. Well, I have no way of knowing.
Are you a Christian?
I was christened in the Catholic Church.
Well, are you a Christian now?
I suppose I am.
Do you believe in our Lord Jesus Christ?
I believe in the teachings of Christ. Am I being tried for witchcraft?
Miss Bryant, tell me, are there no decent, God-fearing Christians among the Bolsheviks?
Does one have to be God-fearing and Christian to be decent? Senator, the Bolsheviks believe that it's religion, particularly Christianity, that's kept the Russian people back for so many centuries.
Miss Bryant.
If any of you had ever been to Russia and seen the peasants, you might think they had a point. On the subject of decency, Senator, the Bolsheviks took power with the slogan, an end to the war. Within 6 months, they made good their promise to the Russian people. Now, the present president of the United States of America went to this country in 1916 on a no-war ticket. Within 6 months, he'd taken us into the war, and 115,000 young Americans didn't come back. That's how decent, God-fearing Christians behave. Give me atheists any time. By the way, Senator Overman, in Russia, women have the vote, which is more than you can say for this country.
Miss Brock. Do you advocate a Soviet government for this country?
No. In this country, I don't think it would work.
Wow.
That is a wow. I've never heard that clip before. You know, separate from actually seeing the movie, where you just single out that clip. Warren did a lot of work on that movie. Warren basically was so consumed by that film. It took him a year to actually film the entire movie, and I think it was the most important professional experience in his life.
One person wanted to know how you see this movie and what it was like for you acting with Warren. How much of the anger and love expressed in that movie was real?
Well, I didn't really take very well to being directed by Warren. I was not a very good sport. Warren was so impassioned, and Warren liked to do many, many takes. Every single setup, there was at least 35 takes. And this included your medium shot, your master shot, and your close-up. So, you know, and then I got a little bit confused about who I was, because what happens is when you do so many takes, you kind of get lost in what you're doing. At the same time, though, I will say this. In a way, it worked very well for the movie. I was so rattled And I think that it brought out a lot of really some very powerful scenes. And so in a way, I always think that I was never really responsible or the author of my own performance, because I feel like my performance in Reds was a response to Warren. Do you understand what I mean?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. I love that movie. I love, and I'm proud of that performance, because it was very, like I said before, it was a very emotional, raw performance.
And, of course, we are talking about Warren Beatty. Did you have a wonderful relationship?
And oh, my God. I mean, he was a dream come true, of course. I mean, it was... I remember that I had this, when he was first, I'll never know why. I remember Warren looking in my face and just, he made me feel like I was suddenly perfect, you know, like that lopsided nose of mine had changed and I could just do about anything. And I remember I was terrified to fly, which I still am, Diane. I'm terrified to fly. I've got to get over it. Tomorrow I'm flying to California. I can't take it. But anyway, I remember one time I was so afraid, and Warren took me to the airport, and he got on board the flight with me. This is a long time ago when you could do that, and he held my hand, and he sat down next to me, and he flew all the way to New York with me, and then I got off the plane, he kissed me goodbye, and flew back to L.A. I mean, it's just so completely romantic. And I think, you know, the thing about Reds was that there was something I didn't like about Louise Bryant. I felt like she was using John Reed to get ahead because she was so insecure and she wanted to be an artist and she wanted to be every bit as good as he was. And I had a problem with liking her while I was playing her. And the one scene that changed my feelings about Louise Bryant was this scene at the end, or close to the end, where she hasn't seen him for a long time and she's been looking for him and they meet at the train station. And I remember at the time, I don't know if you remember, and people won't probably remember, but there was, at that time in life, there was this new instrument called the Walkman. And the Walkman changed the world of music. And what you did is you'd put in, see, you know, a player, and you'd play the Walkman in your ear. And I was playing it when I was about to shoot that. By the way, that scene took 64 takes before I got it right.
Oh.
Listen to me. So anyway, I got the Bob Dylan playing, you know, pressing on. And this is his song from an album of his called Saved. Anything not to hear Warren's direction. This is kind of nice person I was. So there I'm going, and then suddenly I hear action, and I throw the Walkman off my ear, and I start walking down that train, and suddenly, zoom. It was like love came rushing in, and it was Warren, and it was his face approaching mine, and it was love. And so after that, I kind of forgave Louise Bryant for being imperfect. And so I always see that movie as an imperfect love story set against this huge, epic background.
To Wheaton, Maryland. And Lauren, good morning.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'm a fan of both of you, Diane's.
Thank
but my
you.
One question was for Diane Keaton. I've seen all of your movies, and I just think they're all fabulous, but Looking for Mr. Goodbar was so dramatic, dark, and violent. I mm-hmm. wondered how difficult that may have been for you to make.
That's a really interesting question, because I don't really hear about Looking for Mr. Goodbar. People don't talk about it. I remember my father saw it, and he was not happy.
He was not happy.
No, he was not happy. He couldn't stand the way I had to die in that movie. But I, of course, at the time thought, oh, this is fabulous. This is a great part for an actress. I'm an actress, and I can play Annie Hall and Looking for Mr. Goodbar in the same year. They were both made the same year.
Wow.
And
I hadn't recalled that.
Yeah. But the one thing I liked about Looking for Mr. Goodbar was that it was very physical. It was a very physical movie, and I can get lost in that, and I felt very comfortable, oddly enough, in those scenes.
How did you react to your father's negative reaction to it?
Oh, I totally understood it. I mean, why wouldn't he feel? I'm glad he felt that way. He's my father. That's his job, is to care about his daughter.
I remember interviewing the author of that book. I'll never forget reading it. All right, to Winston-Salem, New York, North Carolina. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning. I just really enjoyed listening to the show this morning. I was really interested, Diane Keaton, about your relationship with your mother, because I know you in the book you mentioned about her influence on, I think, as a child, even the clothing you wore and things
yes.
of this nature. And it made me think of my mother. When I think of mothers and relationships, how much they influence their children. And it was really, in many ways, her being, in some ways, it sounded like maybe even a frustrated or potentially an artist. And that she found her influence indirectly through you, because when I think of you, I think of a person who really influenced fashion for women. I was hearing Diane mention what you're wearing today, and I'm wondering if there won't be women thinking about that and maybe looking again. You're eternally beautiful, and thank you very much.
Oh, my God. Isn't that lovely?
Yes. Too good for me.
No. No. And for those of you who are Chico's fans, Diane Keaton is on the cover, and it's just a wonderful outfit. It's got a turtleneck. She's got a black turtleneck on. She's got a cap on half over her forehead. You can only see one eye, and she's got great jewelry, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
Have you always been like this, or do I bring it out in you? I don't think I've ever had this effect on a woman before.
And what effect do you think you're having on me?
I don't quite recognize it. That's how I know I never had it before. So, you don't sleep?
I only need about 4 hours a night.
Me too. I never slept 8 hours in my life.
Me either. I wish I could. Do you want me to shut these? The sun comes in pretty strong in the morning.
Sure.
So, Harry, who are you talking to at this hour?
A friend in L.A. It's only 10 o'clock on the coast.
And that's not past her bedtime?
So you don't get more mellow as the hours pass.
Good night, Harry.
Can I ask you one other thing? What's with the turtlenecks? It's the middle of summer.
No, seriously. Why do you care what I wear?
Just curious.
I like them. I've always liked them, and I'm just a turtleneck kind of gal.
You never get hot?
No.
Never?
Not lately.
How about his voice?
His voice.
Is that one of the all-time great voices?
Yeah, it really is. And I gather for you,
yeah.
He is one of the all-time special men.
Oh, certainly. There's no question about it. Jack is one of the all-time special men. I think every woman who's ever known Jack would say that. And I think he's known a few. Yeah. No, Jack that was the most exciting. That was really, in a way, my favorite film, because it came so late in life, this opportunity to be in a romantic comedy again, to be loved by two men, one the appropriate age, one much younger. I mean, it was like a fantasy come true. Are you kidding?
And you won the Academy Award for it.
No, I didn't.
Not for that.
No.
For Annie Hall.
For Annie Hall, I won the Academy Award. But I did not win it but I was nominated, and it was just a thrill.
It was a fabulous movie.
Oh, that's that Nancy Myers, another writer. I've been really fortunate. I've had some great writer directors. I really have. I mean, Warren, too. Warren, Woody, Nancy.
Do you still remain in contact with Jack Nicholson?
I do. Sometimes I'll go up to his house and have lunch with him. And, I always want to bring a tape recorder. I tell you, there's a book in just listening to his stories. Talk about amazing. But he won't let me. He's not going to.
Why not?
I don't know. I'm gonna approach him again. Do you think I got a chance? I'll try.
Just on tape?
Yeah, no, just, it would, you have no idea. He's by far the most, it's almost, he tells, his mind is absolutely off the charts in terms of how he views the world, how he sees it, what's interesting to him. He's brilliant. He's just, I wish I could, I tell you, Diane, do you think, maybe I could try again.
Maybe he's listening now.
Well, let's hope so.
What's next for you?
Well, what's next for me is I have two movies in the can that are going to be coming out next year.
Tell me about them.
One is called Darling Companion. It's a Larry Kasdan movie. And the other is something with Robert De Niro. This has been a very good year for me to work with my contemporaries. Like, not only was Robert De Niro in this last film that I did called The Wedding, so was Robin Williams. These are two men I don't really know, and I had the opportunity to get, and Susan Sarandon, another person that I didn't know. And all my contemporaries, I feel like I'm beginning to know them. You know, we all live in these kind of separate fiefdoms, and so it's so wonderful to really get to know, you know, people that I've grew up with in the sense of what we did together, you know, in the movies.
And I'm so happy that women of your age, women of Susan Sarandon's age, are still performing
there
on the screen. Diane Keaton's new book, a memoir, it's called Then Again. What a pleasure to talk with
Thank
you.
Thank you. Thank you, Diane. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from